before the next program starts, which will be in just a fraction of a minute.
It just keeps trickling up, and the first hit's free.
From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, this is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, May 3rd. Voters may get the chance to increase Manatee County's ability to buy land for conservation, and it won't cost residents any extra money. In 2020, 71% of Manatee County voters agreed to tax themselves to fund land conservation efforts and protect environmentally sensitive lands from development. With a cost of about $45 per year to the average homeowner, the tax currently generates $6 to $7 million annually. The referendum also authorized the county to bond up to $50 million for an advance on those tax funds. The plan came to fruition this year with the purchases of two new county preserve areas, Crooked River Ranch in Parrish and an expansion of Emercy Point Preserve in Palmetto. But while the tax money continues to flow in, the county is already nearing the limit of how much it can bond in advance for land buys. The county has already bonded $35 million, or more than two-thirds of the $50 million limit approved in the referendum. It could limit how fast the county can invest in future land buys. That's why Manatee County Commissioner George Cruz argues that the cap should have been higher from the beginning, and he proposes asking voters to increase the bond limit. Other commissioners said they were open to considering the idea. If approved, the measure would appear on the November 5 general election ballot. Sarasota County has received more than $187 million in grant requests for $70 million in federal hurricane recovery funds. The $70 million are the portion for government and nonprofits in the $201.5 million Resilient SRQ federal grant program. The Sarasota County Commission is scheduled to review the requests May 22nd. When the county commission starts awarding funds, it can choose to partially fund a request. U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development awarded the $201.5 million Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Funding to Sarasota County to help with recovery from the impact of Hurricane Ian. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for May 3rd.
You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. It seemed Arizona was leading the pack for having the most out-of-touch law governing women's health care, particularly the right to an abortion, by letting legislation from 1864 to kick into effect. But this week, with bipartisan support, Arizona repealed that law, which in my mind is significant because it demonstrated perhaps the first time in recent memory that Republicans crossed their misguided party lines to do the right thing. However, considering the overwhelming support from Republican voters for safe and easy abortions, it was not exactly a political profile in courage. Sure, they might lose some votes from the extreme wing of the party, but based on polls I've seen, a moderate position on the issue is far more common. Meanwhile, this week marked the beginning of the six-week abortion ban in Florida, which had been the last place in the Southeast for many women to go for the procedure. Now, depending on the length of term, women from Florida and most of the Southeast will need to travel as far as Virginia. It has been a mystery to many political observers since Roe v. Wade was overturned, how Republicans could continue to push an agenda that was clearly not in their best interests, or of course, the best interests of women, as they have been soundly thrashed in elections and referenda since. Maybe Florida Republicans could take a hint from Arizona. But first, hear how a recent report by Democrats in Congress reveals how much big oil knew about climate change, their role, and when. A new report released this week by Senate and House Democrats alleges that large oil companies attempted to deceive the public about the effects of climate change for decades. The documents backing the report are finally seeing the light of day after a three-year investigation, which was stuck in limbo after Republicans took back the House in 2022. The joint 66-page report from the Senate Budget and House Oversight Committees claims that some of the largest oil companies have internally acknowledged since the 1960s that fossil fuels cause climate change. The Senate Budget Committee will hold a hearing about the report this week with Rep. Jamie Raskin, the top Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, as a witness. The report comes at the same time that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has called for the federal government to investigate the $60 billion merger between Exxon and Pioneer. The report argues that the oil company has switched from denial of its impact on climate change to a public relations campaign of deception, disinformation, and doublespeak. The industry has portrayed natural gas as a climate-friendly bridge fuel while internally acknowledging that there is significant scientific evidence that the life cycle emissions from gas are as bad as coal, the report says. The report also says that fossil fuel industry has relied on trade organizations like the American Petroleum Institute, API, and the Chamber of Commerce to lobby against action on climate change. It also claims that Exxon, Chevron, Shell, and BP, along with API and the Chamber, obstructed the investigation. The report says lawmakers should hold these companies accountable for the findings of the report, but it doesn't make any specific suggestions, such as criminal referrals to the Department of Justice. The committee's findings further the 2015 report from Inside Climate News and the Los Angeles Times that revealed Exxon's internal research showed the industry's effects on climate change decades ago. These are tired allegations that have already been publicly addressed and through previous congressional hearings and on the same topics and litigation in the courts, Exxon told Axios in a statement. A spokesperson for API told Axios the report featured unfounded election year rhetoric. Axios has reached out to all of the companies and organizations for comment. Meanwhile, in Florida, drilling has just been okayed. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection announced that it intends to allow a Louisiana company to conduct exploratory drilling for oil in the environmentally fragile Apalachicola River floodplain. DEP last week issued the notice of intent to grant a permit for Clearwater Land and Minerals Florida to drill at the site, which is located in rural Calhoun County, in between the Apalachicola and the Chipola rivers and near the Dead Lakes. An exploratory well was built at the site by another company, Chola Petroleum of Dallas, Texas, and permitted by DEP in 2019. Chola, however, opted not to drill in 2021. According to DEP documents, Clearwater intends to drill to a depth of about 14,000 feet from a lime rock drilling pad located within a 3-acre burned area on the land owned by Teal Timber. The drilling proposal sparked opposition from the Apalachicola Riverkeeper, the Franklin County Commission, and the National Wildlife Federation, and more than 600 residents and nonprofits. They cited the potential for catastrophic harm to the river and bay, which is still trying to recover after the collapse of its oyster industry. In a letter sent this week to DEP, Apalachicola Riverkeeper Cameron Baxley expressed profound disappointment in the decision and asked the agency to reconsider. She said that the Apalachicola River Basin supports a diverse array of wildlife, including threatened and endangered species, and that the move by DEP demonstrates a disregard for its long-term health. In addition to the environmental risks, the approval of the Clearwater drilling permit sets a dangerous precedent for the future of Florida, Baxley wrote. By prioritizing potential short-term economic gains of an oil company and landowner over the protection of our natural resources, the DEP sends a message that profit for a few trumps environmental stewardship and sustainable economy for the many. DEP said Clearwater's application included best management practices to reuse or dispose of drilling fluids, cuttings, and formation water. The agency said test fluids and gas will be recovered, sold, flared, or hauled, or permitted to out-of-state facilities. Drilling operations will use water from a nearby well, which requires separate authorization. With DEP's action, Clearwater is required to file notice in a local newspaper, which sets in motion a 21-day period for citizens or nonprofits to challenge the permit application in administrative court. The Apalachicola Riverkeeper had no comment on its next steps or whether it intends to take legal action. If no petition is filed, the agency will issue a final permit allowing exploratory drilling, said Brian Miller, DEP press secretary. Miller noted that the permit would not allow commercial production. This permit requires that the pad be constructed to meet design recommendations for extreme weather conditions, as well as be inspected and certified to ensure the pad, including the surrounding protective berm, is properly constructed prior to the commencement of any drilling operations, Miller said. The Apalachicola River, a legally recognized outstanding Florida water, is the state's largest river by volume. It's considered the most environmentally sensitive, undisturbed floodplain in Florida. In other environmental news, the state wants the power to award permits around wetlands back from the federal government. Florida is firing back at a federal judge that says the state was illegally given authority to review and allow the destruction of protected wetlands, and the state wants permission to process more than 1,000 permit applications that are stuck in the review pipeline. The judge made the legal error, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection says in an April 26 press release. Wetlands are protected by federal and state laws that says there should be no net loss of wetland systems. Wetland dredge and fill permits are granted through Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, and they're often simply referred to as 404 permits. Wetlands consist of everything from seasonal ponds to swamps, creeks and streams, and they're protected for their ecological value and the fact that they clean polluted or tainted waters. U.S. District Court Judge Randolph Moss ruled in Washington, D.C. in February that the EPA legally gave Florida permission to review and approve wetland dredge and fill permits. The DEP in February said the ruling brought the program to an abrupt halt by the stroke of an activist federal judge's pen. Petitioners to the EPA who are against granting Florida 404 permitting rights include Earth Justice, the Center for Biological Diversity, Defenders of the Wildlife, the Sierra Club, the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, the Florida Wildlife Federation, Miami Waterkeeper, and St. John's Riverkeeper. Amber Crooks, environmental policy expert, policy manager at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida in Naples, said there was consideration for a partial program in which Florida would review permits that don't require Endangered Species Act considerations, while the federal agencies would work on the protected species projects. Judge Moss had left an open-ended question whether the federal agencies and the state would operate a partial program and where projects that didn't impact endangered and threatened species would be reviewed by the state, Crook said, but the federal government has said that that would not be their preference and they'd rather have the program back. Bonnie Mallory, a senior attorney at Earth Justice Florida, said developers can simply apply with the Army Corps and get the process going again. They're asking for basically the program to be returned to Florida and operate in full until the process is complete, Malloy said. But all anyone has to do is, you know, is send their permits to the Army Corps to be processed. Joe Camerata, CEO of Camerata Companies, is one of hundreds of developers waiting for wetlands impact permit. He said that he was hours away from getting a permit through Florida and that the Moss ruling will set back his project by a year and a half. We submitted to the Army Corps and we're waiting to see what's going to happen, Camerata said. I believe this is ridiculous. The judge is completely out of touch with reality and what he did hurt Florida. The same thing I'm going to do for the Army Corps is the same thing I'm going to do for 401 through the state. Crook said the bottom line is the state was operating a program that was found to be illegal as it didn't take into consideration issues regarding laws like the Endangered Species Act. Obviously, we don't want to see the program go back to Florida because their program was found to be out of compliance with the law, Crook said. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota. The Department of Energy is exploring ways to use AI for protection and efficiency. The Department of Energy is taking a slew of steps to harness nascent artificial intelligence technologies while preventing an energy crunch, the department announced. The DOE, with its national labs and supercomputing facilities, is uniquely positioned among government agencies to leap from research to applications. The agency is contemplating putting AI to work to make the electrical grid more productive and efficient, to more effectively anticipate problems, and even to speed up permitting. The announcements made this week came in response to an executive order President Biden issued last year. DOE's Science Advisory Board established a working group to focus on the energy needs of data center infrastructures, as well as to convene stakeholders like utilities to get their take on how to meet the energy demands. According to a DOE statement, the Energy Advisory Board working group will make recommendations by June on how the U.S. can best meet the growing energy demand for AI, specifically from data centers housing the backbone of generative AI. In addition, DOE issued a report this week on how it plans to utilize AI as an agency. It identified near-term opportunities for AI to help and manage grids via planning, permitting, operations, and reliability and resilience. The electrical grid of the United States is among the most complex machines on Earth, the report states. DOE sees AI as potentially supporting use cases that meet the country's climate goals. It also identifies AI as a tool to improve forecasts of renewable energy production and for planning networks of charging stations. For example, on the permitting front, the agency sees large language models as potentially assisting federal permitting compliance and review tasks. The DOE finds that managing the downsides of AI, including the possibility of damaging the grid or other infrastructures, will be a key priority. The DOE report concludes that AI is an opportunity to transform the U.S. grid and contribute to rapid decarbonization, albeit with some risks. Emerging applications for AI offer the potential to enable change on the grid at a non-linear pace and scale, the report argues. The Department of National Labs also issued a companion report on AI and the future of energy. The study zeroes in on applications for nuclear energy, the grid, carbon management, energy storage, and energy materials advancements that could be made within the next decade. How the U.S. powers itself and makes its grid more reliable and cleaner depends on how the government manages AI. Seventeen states, including Florida, are suing the federal government over a new policy that really gives workers time off to get an abortion and recover. Republican attorneys general from 17 states filed a lawsuit last week challenging new federal rules entitling workers to time off and other accommodations for abortions, calling these rules an illegal interpretation of a 2022 federal law. The lawsuit led by Tennessee and Arkansas comes since finalized federal regulations were published April 15th and provide guidance for employers and workers on how to implement the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. The language means workers can ask for time off to obtain an abortion and recover from the procedure. The rules, which the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission adopted on a 3-2 vote along party lines, will go into effect June 18th. The lawsuit filed in federal court in Arkansas argues that the regulations go beyond the scope of the 2022 law that passed with bipartisan support. This is yet another attempt by the Biden administration to force through administrative fiat what it can't get passed through Congress, Arkansas Attorney General Tim Griffith said in a statement. Under this radical interpretation of the PWFA, business owners will face federal lawsuits if they don't accommodate employees' abortions, even if those abortions are illegal under state law. An EEOC spokesperson referred questions to the Justice Department, which did not immediately respond to requests for comment. A Better Balance, one of the more vocal advocates for Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, called the lawsuit a baseless attack on the law's protections. This lawsuit represents a bad faith effort to politicize what is a vital protection for health and economic security of millions of families and continuation of the alarming attacks on women's health and reproductive choices, Dina Baxet, the group's co-president, said in a statement. We are committed to fighting to defend workers' rights under the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. The EEOC has said the new law does not obligate employers or employer-sponsored health plans to cover abortion-related costs and that the type of accommodations that most likely will be sought under the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act regarding an abortion is time off to attend a medical appointment or for recovery, which does not have to be paid. The other states joining the lawsuit are Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Utah, and West Virginia. The EEOC has updated a 25-year-old policy to better protect preferred use of pronouns and bathrooms. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, updated federal workplace guidelines after a quarter of a century to protect pronouns, bathrooms, and abortion. The new guidance released this week by the federal agency fortified transgender employees' rights, such as being protected from misgendering and using bathrooms that match their gender identity. Employers not complying with the guidelines are committing unlawful workplace harassment. The agency's update to the guidelines, the first in 25 years, showcases how it would enforce the anti-bias laws, although it is not legally binding. They came, according to the legal standards, shielding workers from harassment in relation to the protected characteristics, ranging from color, race, religion, to sex. Within the last category, gender identity and sexual orientation are included with pregnancy. Abortion was also included as the discrimination towards employees who decided to have one is considered sex discrimination. Harassment, both in person and online, remains a serious issue in America's workplaces, EEOC Chair Charlotte Burrows said in a statement. The EEOC's updated guidance on harassment is a comprehensive resource that brings together best practices for preventing and remedying harassment and clarifies recent developments in the law. The guidance incorporates public input from stakeholders across the country, is aligned with strategic enforcement plan and will help ensure that individuals understand their workplace rights and responsibilities. The expanding guidance has been criticized by conservatives and religious groups. Rep. Virginia Fox, Republican from North Carolina, Education and the Workforce Committee Chairwoman, criticized the updated guidelines and the EEOC, saying that it has detached itself from reality. The EEOC has detached itself from reality. Today's final guidance is nothing more than a homage to leftist activists who want Americans to conform to their warped political ideology, Fox said in a statement. From the mandated use of pronouns to the denial of biological facts, the EEOC seems more interested in appeasing the mob than undertaking common sense policymaking to protect workers. File this one away is another item in the long list of failures spearheaded by this agency. Net neutrality is officially back. The Federal Communications Commission said this week it has terminated a 2017 Memorandum of Understanding with the Federal Trade Commission that had shifted some of the oversight of broadband service providers. The action followed the FCC's decision last week to reinstate landmark net neutrality rules repealed in 2017 under then-President Donald Trump and reclassify broadband service as a telecommunications service. The FCC said it would return to its prior position as the enforcer of rules covering broadband service providers, including prohibitions against blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization practices, transparency requirements, and basic consumer privacy protections that have long applied to phone networks. Under the 2017 memo, the FTC agreed to investigate and take enforcement action against internet service providers for unfair, deceptive, or otherwise unlawful acts or practices before the FCC said it no longer had jurisdiction in terminating the net neutrality rule that had been adopted in 2015 during the Obama administration. Consumers do not want their broadband provider cutting sweetheart deals with fast lanes for some services and slow lanes for others. They do not want their providers engaging in blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization, FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rose Worsell said. If consumers have problems, they can expect the nation's expert authority on communications to be able to respond. Now we can. The FCC said prior commitments included a 2003 Memorandum of Understanding regarding telemarketing enforcement, as well as the 2015 FCC-FTC Consumer Protection Memorandum of Understanding remain in effect. The agencies will continue to share legal, technical, and investigative expertise and experience, the FCC said. The FTC is squarely focused on protecting Americans from illegal business practices, from tackling AI-enabled voice cloning fraud to fighting the scourge of robocalls. We look forward to continuing to work in close partnership with the FCC, FTC Chair Lina Khan said. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota. A redistricting fight over Senate districts is now happening. Florida Secretary of State Cord Byrd has asked a federal court to toss out a lawsuit challenging a state Senate redistricting plan passed in 2022, disputing allegations that the design of two districts in the Tampa Bay area diluted the power of black voters. Attorneys for Byrd filed a motion last week arguing that the three-judge panel should dismiss the case, which was filed April 10th in Tampa. The case, filed on behalf of five residents of Tampa and St. Petersburg, names Byrd and Senate President Kathleen Pasadomo as defendants. The lawsuit alleges that the Senate District 16 and Senate District 18 are gerrymandered and they violate constitutional equal protection rights. District 16, which is represented by Senator Daryl Roussant, a black Democrat from St. Petersburg, crosses Tampa Bay to include parts of Pinellas and Hillsborough counties. White Republican Nick DeSiglia of Indian Rocks Beach represents District 18, which is made up in part of Pinellas County. But in the motion filed last week, Byrd's attorneys argued that the plaintiffs cannot meet the legal test of showing a discriminatory effect as part of the voter dilution claim under the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment. Equal protection is part of the 14th Amendment. The motion said that nowhere in their complaint the plaintiffs ever alleged that the creation of a majority black district is even possible as an alternative to Senate District 18 or Senate District 16, for that matter. The lawsuit makes a series of allegations, including that racial gerrymandering unjustifiably packed black voters into District 16, stripping them of adjacent District 18, and reducing their influence there. The plaintiffs are represented by attorneys from the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida, the Civil Rights and Racial Justice Clinic at New York University School of Law, and the firm of Butler, Weinmuller, Katz, and Craig. The state drew these districts purportedly to avoid diminishing black voters' ability to elect representatives of their choice in District 16, but the state unnecessarily used race to disregard traditional race-neutral redistricting considerations, the 31-page lawsuit said. And far from advancing representation, the enacted districts dilute black voters' power. The state could have drawn these districts to both avoid the diminishment of black voting power and respect traditional redistricting criteria. Instead, the state engaged in racial gerrymandering that unconstitutionally abridges plaintiffs' rights to equal protection of the laws. Lawmakers gave final approval to the redistricting plan in February 2022, and the districts were used in the 2022 elections. Roussant received 63.9% of the vote in District 16, while DeSiglia received 56.9% in District 18. Neither seat is slated to be on this year's ballot. The lawsuit came after a three-judge panel last month rejected a constitutional challenge to the congressional redistricting plan that Governor Ron DeSantis pushed through the legislature in 2022. The state appeals court also rejected a separate challenge to the congressional plan, although an appeal of that decision is pending at the Florida Supreme Court. While congressional redistricting has long been controversial, the Senate map had drawn relatively little attention until the lawsuit was filed in Tampa. The lawsuit seeks a declaration that the districts are unconstitutional, an injunction to block elections from being held in the district, and a remedial decree that ensures plaintiffs live and vote in constitutional districts. Apparently, the Grim Reaper protesting the governor's policies during COVID really got under his skin. The Florida bar is scrapping standard operating procedure in this long-running ethics case against a lawyer who defied and embarrassed Governor Ron DeSantis with a national audience during the run-up for his presidential bid. On orders from the Florida Supreme Court, the bar took the extraordinary step of investigating Daniel Ulfelder twice for the same allegedly unethical conduct when he attacked the governor's COVID-19 policy in 2020. The justices rejected a call from the Florida Bar Board of Governors to have Ulfelder take an ethics refresher course, ending a first round of disciplinary torment and launching a second. "I have not seen that occur ever, said retired Justice R. Fred Lewis, who spent 20 years on the state's highest court. It's like they started all over again." In the second round, a bar lawyer working with the Ulfelder Grievance Committee to find ethics rules he may have broken, the bar wound up citing Ulfelder for this. He failed to tell the First District Court of Appeals his two co-counsels had quit. In fact, under court rules, those Tallahassee lawyers, William Guttner Kitchen and Marie Maddox, were personally responsible for formally asking the court to let them withdraw from the Ulfelder case against DeSantis. This wasn't a task they could delegate to Ulfelder or anyone else. The new Ulfelder charges have nothing to do with the initial claim that the Board of Governors calling for an easy non-punitive resolution. Instead of agreeing as usual, however, the Supreme Court sent the case back to the same grievance committee for a second try. In 2020, Ulfelder embarrassed the governor by dressing up as the Grim Reaper and striding across beaches DeSantis refused to close to the public. National media took note while Florida's COVID-19 death toll spiked. Ulfelder also started a political action committee in his bid to defeat DeSantis in 2022 and campaigned unsuccessfully to be the Democratic alternative to Attorney General Ashley Moody. She and the governor both won re-election. This month, Bar Counsel Olivia Pavia Klein all but admitted conducting a fishing expedition to net new charges against Ulfelder, according to a hearing transcript. Because the grievance committee didn't see the original charge as a major issue, she said, they came out with other rules and discussions about what was going on in the cases. Apparently, all they could find was a technical foul. Plus, two lawyers, Kitchen and Maddox, whose own conduct in the DeSantis case was also under scrutiny by bar regulators. Bar opened files on Kitchen and Maddox, but decided not to file charges against them. The Supreme Court finally agreed that they should be allowed to attend ethics refresher courses, accepting the same recommendation the court rejected for Ulfelder. The Florida Bulldog could not determine whether Kitchen and Maddox made a deal for leniency in exchange for testifying against Ulfelder. Lewis underscored Bar Counsel Klein's statement in the April 2nd hearing without searching for rule violations with Ulfelder's grievance committee. That's the kind of thing that happens when somebody's just struggling, grasping at straws, Lewis said. It's almost an admission of weakness of the position. They couldn't support what the court told them, so they had to go look and find something else. It's official. Florida is at the bottom of teacher pay in the country. After hovering close to dead last in the nation for average teacher pay for years, the state of Florida has dropped even further. The Sunshine State sits second to last in national rankings of all 50 states in the District of Columbia this year, according to a new report released by the National Education Association. According to the NEA, a labor union representing over 3 million educators and school staff in the United States, Florida's average teacher salary of $53,098 is the lowest in the entire country, behind only West Virginia, where average pay is $52,870. Florida ranked 48th in the nation last year and is ranked number 50 this year. That puts the state, which has launched multiple political attacks on teachers and their unions in recent years, below pay rankings even among southern right-to-work states where teachers' unions either aren't legally allowed to collectively bargain or otherwise have limited resources and power to negotiate higher pay for teachers. This new ranking from the NEA, pulling data from the 2022-2023 school year, is a drop from last year's rankings where Florida did rank 48th in average teacher pay. Nationwide, the NEA's report shows that the annual teacher salary actually increased 4.1%, reaching $69,544. Clinton McCracken, president of the Orange County Classrooms Teachers Association, a local NEA affiliate representing roughly 13,600 teachers and school staff, says the state is failing our students with its lack of investment. It's imperative for elected officials to take decisive action to restore respect for teachers and ensure that they can afford to live, pay bills, and support families, McCracken told the Orlando Weekly in a statement. The state is failing our students when it refuses to address fair and competitive pay for educators, as this exacerbates the critical teacher and staff shortages in Florida. Teacher shortages in Florida schools have been a chronic and worsening problem over the past couple of years, with some school districts at times seeing dozens of vacancies in instructional and support staff positions. Teachers and their unions blame this issue in part on non-competitive pay amidst an increase in Florida's cost of living, pricing public educators out of their own communities or otherwise forcing them to find a job that they can better support themselves and their families. State officials, meanwhile, have argued that Florida has championed policies to improve the teaching profession. Teachers shouldn't have to take on second and third jobs in order to pay bills, said McCracken. The Orange County Teachers Union recently ratified a new union contract that delivers nearly 10% raise for most teachers in the district and raises starting teacher pay from $49,375 up from $48,400. Andrew Sparr, president of the statewide teachers union, hasn't been shy about where he places the blame for Florida's position in national rankings. Time and time again, anti-education politicians say they support teachers. But the proof is undeniable, Sparr said in a statement. In the past 5.5 years since Governor DeSantis took office, Florida's public school teachers have experienced a stagnant and declining average salary. Governor DeSantis has yet to receive or approve the state budget approved by the state lawmakers for the 2024-2025 fiscal year, a budget proposal that the FVA stated they disapprove of for lack of sufficient investment. Options for protest, however, are limited in Florida. Teachers are legally prohibited from engaging in any sort of strike and can face fines or even lose their teaching licenses for doing so. This hasn't stopped educators in other non-strike states like West Virginia and Massachusetts from launching illegal strikes, which have historically stemmed from issues such as stagnant wages, proposed increases to health care costs, and divestment in public school education that leaves schools ill-equipped to properly staff and address issues in schools. Curiosity could not kill this traveling cat. In the famous Schrödinger's cat hypothesis, a cat in a box is both alive and dead until someone looks inside. And in the case of one mischievous cat from Utah discovered inside an Amazon return package, it was very much alive. The cat, Galena, survived being shipped all the way from Lehi, Utah, across the U.S. to California after sneaking into the package. Galena, 6, an indoor-only cat, traveled more than 500 miles in a 3x3 shipping container, according to NBC. Galena endured 6 days of travel with no food or water, but was discovered in relatively good shape by an Amazon employee. Her owner, Carrie Clark, first discovered that her beloved companion was missing on April 10th. Family and friends quickly helped her look for the cat, passing around posters. Galena, our super shy indoor cat, escaped today. Clark wrote about Galena's disappearance to a Facebook group for lost pets. She's part of our family and has never been gone this long before. A week later, Clark and her husband got an astonishing notification from Galena's microchip. The cat had been discovered in Los Angeles. At first, she thought the notification was a mistake, but Galena, the cat, actually had been mailed cross-country. Brandy Hunter, an Amazon worker at California Warehouse, said co-workers informed her that they had found a cat in a return package, Hunter said on Facebook. Hunter, who self-described as a crazy cat lady, took Galena in for the night, then to the local veterinarian. When the vet scanned Galena's microchip, the Clarks were instantly notified, and the vet also called the Clarks to confirm Galena was now in their care. The Clarks hopped on a plane, traveled to California to be reunited. While much skinnier, Clark confirmed Galena was completely unharmed. She believes Galena may have gotten into the Amazon box while they were trying to seal the return delivery, and she told the New York Times, because the box already weighed more than 30 pounds, they didn't notice the extra weight. she doesn't meow a lot, and she loves boxes. So for her, she was really happy in that moment, I'm sure, although I'm sure that wasn't the case later on. Lucky for Galena the cat, she was not mailed to South Dakota, where animals can be shot for being themselves. Politicians and dog experts are criticizing South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem after she wrote in a new book about killing a rambunctious puppy. The story and the vilification she received on social media has some wondering whether she's still a viable potential running mate for presumptive Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. Experts who work with hunting dogs like Noem said she should have trained, not killed the pup, or found other options if the dog was out of control. Noem has tried to reframe the story from two decades ago as an example of her willingness to make tough decisions. She wrote on social media that the 14-month-old wire-haired pointer named Cricket had shown aggressive behavior by biting. As I explained in the book, it wasn't easy, she said on X, but often the easy way isn't the right way. Still, Democrats and even some conservatives have been critical. This story is not landing. It is not a facet of rural life or ranching to shoot dogs, conservative commentator Tommy Lahren posted online. Several posters described Noem as Cruella de Vil, the villain from the Disney classic 101 Dalmatians. A meme features a series of dogs offering looks of horror. I'm not sure which thing she did was stupider, the fact that she murdered the dog or the fact that she was stupid enough to publish it in a book, said Joan Payton of the German Wire-Haired Pointer Club of America. The club itself describes the breed as high energy and said Noem was too impatient and her use of a shock collar for training was botched. But South Dakota Democratic Senate Minority Leader Reinhold Nesba considered the disclosure more calculated than stupid. He said the story has circulated for years among lawmakers that Noem killed the dog in a fit of anger and that there were witnesses. He speculated that it was coming out now because Noem is being vetted as a candidate for vice president. She knew that this was a political vulnerability and she needed to put it out there before it came up in some other venue, he said. Why else would she write about it? In her soon-to-be-released book, No Going Back, The Truth on What's Wrong with Politics and How We Move America Forward, of which The Guardian obtained a pre-release copy, Noem writes that she took Cricket on a bird hunting trip with older dogs in hopes of calming down the wild puppy. Instead, Cricket chased the pheasants, attacked the family's chickens on a stop on the way home, and then whipped around to bite me, she wrote. Afterward, Noem wrote, she led Cricket to the gravel pit and killed her. She said she also shot a goat that the family owned, saying it was mean and liked to chase the kids. The response to the story was swift. Post a picture with your dog that doesn't involve shooting them and throwing them in a gravel pit. I'll start, Democratic Minnesota Governor Tim Walz posting on X. The post included a photo of him feeding ice cream off a spoon to his Labrador mix named Scout. Democrat Hillary Clinton reposted a 2021 comment in which she warned, "Don't vote for anyone you wouldn't trust with your dog," she added this week. Still true. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota. Moscow Marjorie is losing influence in Congress to those who just want to govern. House Democrats met Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene's plan to force a vote on ousting Speaker Mike Johnson with dismissal and derision. Democrats hope that a resounding defeat for Greene will crush her nascent revolt and discourage right-wing hardliners from continuing to try to throw the House into chaos. She is about to realize her inevitable irrelevance, one senior House Democrat told Axios just minutes after Greene made her announcement. Another senior House Democrat cast Greene's motion as drama that hurts Republicans. During a press conference outside the Capitol on Wednesday morning, Green told reporters that she will force a vote on her motion to vacate the speaker's chair next week. Next week, I'm going to be calling this motion to vacate. Absolutely, I'm calling it, she said. I can't wait to see Democrats go out and support a Republican speaker and have to go home to their primaries and have to run for Congress again, having supported a Republican speaker, a Christian conservative. Green's announcement comes just one day after House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries and his leadership team announced that they would vote to table, kill any motion to vacate. Most House Democrats are expected to stand behind them and vote to table the motion, senior Democratic sources told Axios. Most Democrats will follow Hakeem, said one senior House Democrat. Rep. Becca Boleyn, a Democrat from Vermont, an openly gay progressive, told Axios she will vote to table, but I will not do it happily. Johnson's positions and actions on LGBTQ rights and reproductive rights are abhorrent to me and the vast majority of my constituents, she said, adding that her voters are furious about Johnson's role on January 6th. But, she said, my constituents and I want a functioning Congress. I will vote to end the chaos and strip MTG of her power and influence. One House Democrat speculated Johnson is trying to bring this to a head so that Republicans are forced to decide between crazy and just plain old arch conservative. But the lawmaker argued, Green has no choice. Her brand is to be a firebrand, and constituents expect it. If she doesn't file the motion, she looks weak. Filing it and losing is better for her crazy narrative about how all Republicans are Democrats now. Republican Steve Cohen, a Democrat from Tennessee, argued that Green's tactic will backfire and make Speaker Johnson even stronger and encourage him to work with Democrats. There will be at least a small pocket of progressives who refuse to vote to table Green's motion. Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal of Washington told reporters she's going to vote against tabling it. I respect what our leaders decided, and I understand why he decided it, and I appreciate that he has been very clear. This is a narrow, very narrow, one-time deal, she added. She raises money off chaos. That's her real goal, Rep. Greg Landsman, a Democrat from Ohio, said of Green. Unfortunately for her, most of us are determined to govern. Former Trump aide Steve Bannon is facing the same judge as his former boss in New York. Top Donald Trump ally Steve Bannon appeared in a New York court this week in connection with allegations that he defrauded people who donated to a campaign to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Bannon, a former White House senior advisor, was scheduled to appear in front of Judge Juan Merchant for pretrial motion hearings at the New York Supreme Criminal Court, where Bannon's lawyers are expected to argue that the case should be thrown out. Bannon has pleaded not guilty to several charges of money laundering, conspiring, and conspiracy, and scheming to defraud in connection with a $15 million in donations of We Build the Wall fundraising campaign received. Merchant originally scheduled Bannon's trial to take place in May, but he has since postponed the case until September. The judge is presiding over Trump's hush money trial, which is on break for Wednesdays and expected to last several more weeks. Newsweek had contacted Bannon for comment via email. In September of 2022, Bannon was charged in connection with a money laundering allegations that stemmed from a GoFundMe campaign to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, a key 2016 campaign promise from Trump. Bannon was previously charged in an almost identical federal investigation before being pardoned by Trump hours before the then president left office in January of 2021. Manhattan prosecutors received the investigation in September of 2022 with state-level charges against Bannon, which are not covered by presidential pardons. Bannon was also found guilty of two counts of contempt of Congress in July 2022 after defying a subpoena issued to him by the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack. He has not spent any time in jail pending the result of an appeal. In April 2023, Brian Colfage, a U.S. Air Force veteran and founder of the We Build the Wall organization, was sentenced to over 4 years in jail after he pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit wire fraud and other tax and wire fraud charges in connection with the millions donated to the campaign, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York said in a press release. Andrew Baldonado, a co-defendant, also pleaded guilty to wire fraud conspiracy and was sentenced to 3 years. A third defendant, Timothy Shea, was found guilty at a trial of conspiracy to commit wire fraud, conspiracy to commit money laundering, and obstruction of justice. In July, he was sentenced to 63 months in prison and 3 years of supervised release. Shea was also ordered to forfeit $1,801,707 and pay restitution in the amount of $1,801,707. All three men were found to have devised a scheme to move donations to the Build the Wall campaign through entities and bank accounts they controlled, the office said. They took steps to obscure or conceal the payments, including by using fake invoices and sham contracts. Last summer, Derica Richard felt stuck. She didn't have enough money to afford childcare for her three youngest children, ages 1, 2, and 3, yet the demands of caring for them on a daily basis made it impossible for Richard, a hairstylist, to work. One child care assistance program rejected her because she wasn't working enough. It felt like an unsolvable quandary. Without care, she couldn't work. Without work, she couldn't afford care. But Richard's life changed in the fall when, thanks to a new city-funded program for low-income families called City Seats, she enrolled the three children in Claire's Little Lambs, a child care center in the West Bank neighborhood of New Orleans. For the first time, she's earning enough to pay her bills and afford online classes. "It actually paved the way for me to go to school," Richard said. And one morning this spring, after walking the three children to their classrooms, "City Seats," she said, "changed my life." Last year, New Orleans added more than 1,000 child care seats for low-income families after voters approved a historic property tax increase in 2022. The referendum raised the budget of the program sevenfold, from $3 million to $21 million a year for 20 years. Because Louisiana's Early Childhood Fund matches the money locally raised for child care, the city now gets an additional $21 million to help families find care. New Orleans is part of a growing trend of communities passing ballot measures to expand access to child care. In Whatcom County, Washington, a property tax increase added $10 million for child care and children's mental health to the county's annual budget. A marijuana sales tax approved last year by voters in Anchorage, Alaska, will generate more than $5 million for early childhood programs. The state of Texas has taken a somewhat different tack. In November, voters approved a state constitutional amendment that allows tax relief for qualifying child care providers. Under this provision, cities and counties can choose to exempt a child care center from paying all or some of its property taxes. Dallas was among the first city and county combo in Texas to approve the tax break. The recent local initiatives are focused on younger children, infants, and toddlers more than ever before, said Diane Giron, a senior state policy analyst with Child Care Aware, a nonprofit research and advocacy group. "In the past, we saw more of these local and state-driven initiatives focusing on pre-K, but over the last few years, we've seen voters approve ballot measures to invest in child care and early learning," she said. "The value of child care and other parts of the care economy become abundantly clear to a lot of business leaders in a painful way," Allen said. For some Americans, the child care crisis has continued, keeping them from being able to hold down jobs and advance in their careers. The number of parents who reported missing work because of child care surged in 2020 at the start of COVID-19 outbreak. It has yet to recede to pre-pandemic levels. In Louisiana, 27% of households with kids under the age of 5 reported a child care disruption in February or March, according to the Census Household Pulse Survey data analyzed by the Associated Press in partnership with the Education Reporting Collaborative. In New Orleans, a city with many in the service industry and other low-wage jobs, the city seats funding has been transformative for parents struggling to hold down demanding mostly non-unionized jobs.